who, while he was president, oversaw the greatest destruction of the Amazon in any recent presidency. It's great that he's not above the law, that there isn't impunity, but there will be a fight back. You can be sure this is not over.
Jonathan Watt, I want to thank you for being with us, The Guardian's global environment writer, speaking to us from Belém, Brazil, where the UN COP took place. And Brandon Wu, director of policy and campaigns at ActionAid USA, just back from Belém. I'm Amy Goodman, also just back from Belém.
Support for KFAI comes from The Dakota, presenting Nicholas David, St. Nick's Show, and album release Wednesday, December 3rd. After 5 years in the making, Nicholas Davis is celebrating his first vinyl release, More Than Music. The St. Paul singer-songwriter has been making music for nearly 30 years. Nicholas David blends soul, country, gospel, and rock to create a sound unlike anyone else. More information about Nicholas David, St. Nick's Show, and album release is available at DakotaCooks.com.
You are listening to Fresh Air Community Radio, KFAI, 90.3 FM in Minneapolis and on the web at kfai.org. Radio without boundaries.
You're listening to Miniculture on KFAI. November 10th marks 50 years since the Edmund Fitzgerald vanished beneath the dark waters of Lake Superior. One of the Great Lakes' largest freighters, she carried a heavy load of iron ore when a fierce gale struck, overwhelming the vessel and sinking her before any distress signal could be sent. All 29 crew members were lost. The story might have faded from memory were it not for a song by the Canadian folk singer Gordon Lightfoot. His song captured the tragedy in a haunting ballad that kept the memory of the ship and the storm alive. KFAI's Allison Young has the story.
One late night in 1976, Dave Strandberg was on air at WAKX in Duluth when he got a call from a listener. She wanted to know if he'd gotten a new album that just came out.
And she said there's a great song on there called Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald. The legend lives on. It was obviously quite profound and resonated with this area since the Fitz left the Twin Ports and its last journey. So I played it, and immediately the phone started ringing. What's that song? Play it again.
Dave ended up playing the song three times during those overnight hours, likely the first DJ in the country to play it. And it would not take long before Gordon Lightfoot's The Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald was a hit, not only in the Great Lakes, but around the world, reaching number two in the Billboard Hot 100 chart in the U.S. and number one in Lightfoot's native Canada. The song closely follows what happened to the Fitzgerald 50 years ago this November 10th. The gales of November came early that terrible night, with winds kicking up to 65 miles per hour and creating 25-foot waves on Lake Superior. The last words from Captain Ernest McSorley were, "We are holding our own." After that, the ship disappeared from radar and vanished beneath the lake's surface in driving snow. No one survived. Gordon Lightfoot, who died in 2023 at the age of 84, told NPR's Scott Simon that he got the idea for the song after reading about the wreck in Newsweek magazine.
I saw an article in Newsweek magazine. I said, God, I said, this is short shrift for such a monumental event. But what really spurred me on, I noticed that they were spelling the name wrong. It's spelled Edmund. They'd use it with an O instead of a U. And I said, that's it. I said, if they're spelling the name wrong, I got to get into this.
Curiously, that Newsweek article, The Cruelest Month, written by James Gaines, begins poetically, almost as if inviting Lightfoot to take it from here. It reads, "According to a legend of the Chippewa tribe, the lake they once called Gitche-Gumee never gives up her dead.
The lake, it is said, never gives up her dead when the skies of November."
Lightfoot admitted it was a big undertaking to find every article written about the tragedy and begin putting the facts into chronological order. But what was not difficult for him was landing on a melody. He claimed it's not original, but rather an Irish dirge, one of the first pieces of music that he remembered hearing as a child. And it's precisely that elegiac quality that makes the song so memorable.
The first time I heard it, it was 10 November when I was a kid, and there was a radio broadcast that was talking about the Fitz and stuff, and the song came on, and it was as my parents were pulling into our garage, and I made them sit to wait to listen to the entirety of the song, because I was like, this is cool, what is this?
Kaylee Matuzak is a park ranger at the Lake Superior Maritime Visitor Center in Duluth. She says the Fitzgerald is the most popular exhibit in the museum. There's a detailed model, an interpretive kiosk, and an interview with the captain of the ship that was closest to the Fitz when it disappeared. They even have a life ring that was discovered floating on the surface after the ship was lost.
People will, like, literally come in here, they will go to the Fitzgerald exhibit, and then they'll just put the song on their phones. But it really, I think, helps make it, like, more of a tangible thing than just something that's in a song.
All these years later, it's hard to think of a world without Lightfoot's song, but it was definitely an unlikely hit, especially along other chart toppers of the day, like Rod Stewart's Tonight's the Night, The Wings' Silly Love Songs, and the Bee Gees' You Should Be Dancing. For starters, it's in a slow, rocking 6/8 time, much like the movement of a boat. It's in a minor key, and there's no bridge or chorus. But maybe most unusual for a rock ballad, it's long, lasting 6 minutes, nearly twice as long as other hits of the era. But what seems to stop people in their tracks are the words. Meticulously crafted details like the ship's size, 26,000 tons, that there were only 15 miles left to reach the safety of Whitefish Bay, and the tolling bells at Detroit's Mariners Church in honor of the 29 men lost. Even the choice of instruments backing up Lightfoot's gentle baritone create a mood, including the steel guitar with its forlorn sound like the wailing of wind or even tears.
Does anyone know where the love of God goes when the waves turn the minutes to hours?
But Dave Strandberg tells me that Lightfoot's song was never about exploiting the tragedy, but rather to honor those who died and create a lasting legacy. When investigators later determined that the wreck was not caused by crew error, Lightfoot changed the words to reflect the new evidence. The line that went, "At 7 p.m., a main hatchway caved in," was changed to, "At 7 p.m., it grew dark, it was then." Lightfoot sang the new lyrics in all subsequent performances. In 1989, Superior Mayor Herb Bergson declared Lightfoot to be an honorary citizen of the city. The official resolution said, "Were it not for the talent of Mr. Gordon Lightfoot, the 29 crew members of the Edmund Fitzgerald would be only a forgotten statistic." Lightfoot came to the Twin Ports many times throughout his career, one time meeting Dave Strandberg and signing a gold record for him, commemorating an unlikely hit that has resonated for nearly five decades.
In fact, he didn't expect it to be a hit either. It was just an album cut for him. So kind of surprised, I think, to everybody that it turned out to be a super hit.
For KFAI, I'm Allison Young.
Listening to Mini Culture on KFAI. Every year, the St. Paul Regional Water Services opens up the historic Highland Water Tower for public viewing. At 127 feet tall, it occupies one of the highest points in the city, giving visitors a spectacular and unique view of the Twin Cities. In 2025, the tower will be open on Saturday and Sunday, October 11th and 12th. KFAI's Hans Buto had the opportunity to get into the tower and take a look at the view.
Man, it's a gorgeous fall day on the corner of Snelling and Ford Parkway in St. Paul. It's foggy today across from the Speedway in the Parkway Auto Care, but if I turn around, I get to see this. Oh, eight sides, tall. Hello.
Hello, how are you doing today?
I'm good, I'm Hans.
Hi, I'm Jody Walling. I work over at St. Paul Regional Water Services, and this is our Highland Park Water Tower, the historic Highland Park Water Tower. Which is to say the 1928 version of the Highland Park Water Tower, because we do have the million gallon and the million and a half gallon tanks off in the distance. And when people are coming down Snelling Avenue and they see the big hill, and in the wintertime, sometimes people will sled down that hill.
Yeah,
that actually holds 10 million gallons of water.
10 million gallons. That's so much water.
That is so much water, which makes the 200,000 gallon tank in here kind of irrelevant. And so it was decommissioned in 2017.
So cool. So do you mind if we go in?
Not at all. The acoustics in here are a little bit echoey.
I love echoey. Oh, wow. Yeah, it is.
Because as you can see, there's a big tank in the middle of the building.
Yeah.
And it's circular around that tank. So the staircase that brings you to the observation deck up on the top, which is why a lot of people come here during the open houses,
yeah,
is to view the city and the Minneapolis skyline and the St. Paul City skyline, and they watch the airplanes take off and land at the airport. And you have to go 151 steps up in a circular staircase around that tank to get to the observation deck.
That's so cool. Do you mind if we go up?
I don't mind. We'll all have to unlock it for us.
So this is built in 1928.
It was built in 1928. So they actually started building like in 1927, and it was finished in 1928.
Okay. And who's they?
Okay, so the city of St. Paul built it, but the architect in charge of it was Clarence Cap Wigington, who happens to be the first black municipal architect in the entire country, let alone the city of St. Paul.
Yeah.
He was a captain in the Home Guard for the African-American Battalion in World War I.
So he's the first black...
Municipal architect.
So what are some of the other buildings people might know of his?
So if you go to Holman Airport, the administration building there, he did that. There's actually the Harriet Park Pavilion, which is now named after him, which is the Wigington Pavilion and Harriet Island. So the Roy Wilkins Annex, he did the exterior of that. He did the clubhouse over at the Highland Park Highland Golf Course.
So cool.
Should we head up one more level? So we're standing next to now, or as we walk up, we're actually next to this big riveted
water tank.
Yeah.
So the 200,000 gallon tank. It still stands in the center of the building, and you have to walk around it. In the summertime here, it used to get really sweaty because the water was so much colder than the air and the humidity out here. Like today is a really humid day. This tank would have been full of sweat.
We are almost there. Should we do the last little bit? Oh boy.
And then I'm gonna have to get a key and open the door for us.
But it's getting brighter, so we're getting to the top, and there's this beautiful, what do you call it, a cupola? Yeah.
And there's these really cool copper doors at the top.
Ooh, those are gorgeous. Very 1928.
Very reminiscent of that time, yes.
Yeah, yeah. And there's Snelling Avenue again. You can hear it bright and clear.
And you can smell they're starting to cut the grass.
Oh, yeah.
And normally, if the fog wasn't so heavy today, you can actually see quite far. So out this south window, you could see out to the Pine Bend Refinery out in Rosemont. And that's a good 10, 12 miles away from here.
It's so far.
And if you kind of go to the south, southwest kind of, you can watch the planes take off and land from the Minneapolis International Airport, you know, because you have this unique bird's eye vantage point of being able to see them actually coming in and taking off at the same time from different runways.
Yeah.
Out the totally west window and a little bit to the northwest, you can see St. Yeah. Catharines University. They have a little water tower tank of their own.
Yeah.
Out the west, northwest window, you can see the Witch's Tower over in Prospect Park.
Oh, yeah, over
in
Minneapolis.
Over in Minneapolis. And looking out the north window, if you follow Snelling all the way down, you can actually see the state fairgrounds, and the water tank there actually says fairgrounds.
Oh, yeah.
Then we have the 2 1-million-gallon and the 1.5 million gallon water towers that are just off to the north, northeast. So kind of behind those blue towers, a little bit to the right of those towers, you can actually see the St. Paul Cathedral. And that's kind of up on a hill in downtown also, so it stands out from the rest of the skyline.
And gives you a sense of like the topography of the Twin Cities, because you can really see a lot, just a very different vantage point of a lot of the cities here.
Oh yeah, I mean, because you can see the St. Paul skyline, you can see the Minneapolis skyline, you can kind of see the neighborhoods in between a little bit. And because St. Paul is a little hillier than some cities, you can actually see where higher points are, like where the cathedral is, which is one of the reasons why this tower happens to be built where it is, because it's on a high vantage point. Mm-hmm. And that makes this observation deck one of the highest points in the entire city.
Oh, so that's cool. So yeah, you're right, yeah.
Yeah, the vantage point is really spectacular.
That's
right.
Cool.
And so if you look straight out looking east, you can actually see the golf course right below us. Mm. The Highland Park Golf Course, and then off in the distance you can kind of see where the Schmidt Brewery artist lofts are.
Right. Down in 7th.
Down in 7th.
Yeah.
there's just a lot to see up here. I always encourage people to bring binoculars so that you can kind of zoom in on different things, you know, watch the golfers or, you know, see the rides over at the...
Or the airplanes taking off.
Or the airplanes taking off and landing, you know, so you can actually get kind of a really close-up view of them. If you got the bigger cool camera, that's always a cool thing to have those pictures from up here, especially in the fall when the leaves are changing color.
Oh, totally worth it.
Absolutely.
You've been listening to Miniculture on KFAI. Support for Miniculture comes from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. For more stories like this, check out the Miniculture tab on kfai.org. You are listening to Miniculture on KFAI. Grand Marais is a tourist town on Minnesota's north shore of Lake Superior. One weekend every summer, the town gets taken over with a celebration of fish, local culture, and bingo. KFAI contributor Joe Fredericks checks it out.
It's hot in downtown Grand Marais. The town's annual celebration of small town living, known as Fisherman's Picnic, is just underway. Smoke hangs thick in the air, a great gray, omnipresent hue that's drifted down from a string of Canadian wildfires. Not even the gentle breeze blowing across the blue depths of Lake Superior can keep the town cool today. Through the heat and smoke on this Friday afternoon in early August, someone calls out letters and numbers from under the shade of a massive tent. The tent sits in a gravel parking lot that belongs to the nearby hardware store. The repetition of the call could be mistaken for a chant.
Under the
N40.
In 2025, Fisherman's Picnic celebrated its 96th year. The annual event that makes competitive sports out of everything from log rolling to a contest where people literally toss fish to one another takes this already busy tourist town to the next level of bustling. With a population of about 1,300 people, downtown Grand Marais changes dramatically when some 10,000 people arrive to join the celebratory atmosphere that is Fisherman's Picnic. Hotels are booked solid, with reservations being made up to a year in advance. Fisherman's Picnic typically takes place the first weekend in August. It's hosted by the Grand Marais Lions Club, which sells raffle tickets and also caters to hungry attendees by offering more than 1,000 pounds of their legendary fish burgers, breaded herring, served on a large bun. Then there's the bingo tent. Throughout the weekend, the bingo tent is a big-time draw. People sit for hours, tossing down a buck per card for a chance to win $10. Teenagers, grandparents, and all ages in between gather under the tent to try their luck. Adults stand nearby in the shadows, many of them drinking beer. The caller is a member of the local high school football team. He reaches for the bingo ping pong balls from inside something that looks and acts like a movie theater popcorn popper. After a dozen calls, a young woman sitting at a long card table erupts with a celebratory call.
Bingo! Bingo! Bingo!
Hey, hold the cards. That's a bingo!
Moments after the teen celebrates her victory, another big winner walks by. She's holding two frothy beers, some of the ale spilling over the rim of the plastic cup in her left hand. Her name is Deborah Van Valkenburg, and she's won a few games of bingo this year. Deborah says she's been coming down to the bingo tent at Fish Pick as long as she's been around town.
This is the second summer, because I just moved here. Okay. Moved up here, like, with the dog, knew no one.
Deborah bought a house near a creek that flows into Lake Superior back in 2023. She's far from a local, but she's not someone who's just here for the weekend either. She likes the bingo tent, she says, because she tends to win.
I won that twice.
Nice.
I know.
And so you won three games out of how many, approximately?
Oh, probably 20.
20? That's not bad. That's pretty,
20,
pretty
maybe
good
30.
Odds,
I don't know. I don't know. Yeah.
A few games.
Yeah, it was.
Many of the fundamental elements of Fisherman's Picnic have remained the same for more than 90 years. Fish tossing, loon calling, and embracing the local culture. However, some things have changed. Absent these days is the carnival that once accompanied the weekend, including the Ferris wheel that offered spectacular views of the big lake, though some smaller rides do still give kids a spin. The piles of sawdust that once hid pennies for kids to find are also gone. These days, it's common to find a person staring at their phone while they're at Fish Pick. Instead of searching through sawdust, you might see someone searching for the perfect selfie to post on their Instagram account. It's the same everywhere, one can't help but think. Not in the bingo tent, though. When the fireworks start Saturday night, another long-running tradition, the bingo keeps on going. Not even explosives can stop this game.
B-8.
On Sunday, the last day of the festival, a parade rolls through town. Jay White and her parents, who live in nearby Silver Bay, go to the bingo tent after the parade. Before long, they find a spot in the winner's circle.
I'm Jay White, and I've been coming to Fish Pick for over 10 years now, playing bingo every year, several hands, including with like my whole family and everything, and this was the first year that we actually won. I won bingo twice, so I won bingo on Thursday afternoon, and then I won again on Sunday afternoon. I do feel like I psychically called out the last two numbers of my first bingo on Thursday, because I was staring at the number, and I'm like, N36. And then she said N36. I'm like, oh, that's hilarious. Like, and I was like, okay, 062 or whatever the last one was. And she said it right after, so I got the last two right in a row. And both times in my brain, I was like saying it. But then I tried that same strategy on Sunday, and it did not work. So I don't think I'm really psychic.
Fish Pick is a locals holiday in Grand Marais. Graduates from the local high school come back to celebrate their hometown, throngs of tourists who have no roots to the town mixed in with the locals, including some of those who have no plans to ever leave. Fish Pick is a celebration of a small town in a remote part of the state, one known for its rugged lake shores and all the artists who live here. People love Grand Marais. It's a cool town, according to Instagram and Visit Cook County, the local tourism agency. You should come check it out, they say. And if you come in August, you might even win $10 playing bingo.
11. D54. D54.
You're listening to Mini Culture on KFAI. Some people are a mama's boy, a daddy's girl, an auntie's angel, a dog's best friend. Tamika Jones is a grandma's gal. It was her grandmother's unconditional love that set her on the path of exploration and determination in starting her own business. KFAI's Sundis Hassan Nouli shares this portrait of a woman whose dreams were supported and uplifted by her grandmother.
In my grandma's bathroom, she had this really old-time vanity, big mirror, lots of drawers, and in every single drawer, there was either rollers, hairpins, mascara, lipstick, because my grandma wore makeup. And so I would close the door to the bathroom, and she had a tape cassette, and I would turn on, and she only listened to gospel. And so I would turn on her music, and I would go through her drawers and just be like, ooh, what is that? Ooh, that lipstick color is cute. And she would come in, and she would not care that I was in her vanity. That really was impactful for me because that love that I felt in that space is what made me now have a lipstick company and be a makeup artist for all those years.
Elder women play an important role in our society,
and I don't think they get enough credit for how much their truth-telling shapes our lives as a collective. I know this for sure, because I wouldn't be here without the elder women in my life. As a Somali-American woman whose family resettled in Minnesota because of war, it was the elder women who held the community together when our parents went out to work. They stayed home and told stories of yesteryear. With no certainty, no roadmap, they preserved our collective memories over tea and cookies. Whether it's around kitchen tables, porches, family dinners, or pictures in the photo album, we owe our survival to the countless older women who decided to sit down, tell a story, and encourage passion and thinking. Business owner Tamika Jones is a product of that kind of wisdom. Tamika's story starts long before her first lipstick sale. It begins with summers at her grandmother's house, learning, laughing, and being told that she could explore beauty without apology. That kind of love shapes a person. Now, we find Tamika, a proud owner of Lipesteem, a paraben-free and cruelty-free lipstick line made in the U.S. Her flagship store is located in the historic neighborhood of Rondo, on Selby Avenue, part of town where many African-American families moved to after the construction of Interstate 94 Highway ripped through the Rondo district in the 50s and 60s. This is only part of Tamika's story. In her own words, let's take a listen.
My parents were about 21, 22 when they had me, and they were both very busy entrepreneurs and business people. And because my parents were really busy, we were raised by other people. My parents also eventually became pastors. And so they lived a middle-class life, and they wanted something different for their kids than they had. And so they ended up putting us in private schools where we were one of the only Black children. And that was kind of strange, going to school with all white students, coming back to the house where it's an all Black community. And so I kind of lived in between two worlds all the time growing up. I didn't always feel comfortable in all the spaces where I was. And it wasn't until my grandmother moved to California, my brother and I used to go visit her every summer, because normally we stayed with my grandma. When she lived here, we were always with my grandma. When she moved, we could only be with her in the summers. Like, she allowed me that space for me to be me. Because I kind of had the experience of living in multiple places as an adult, it really helped, right? As a kid, I was always fighting because people would say things about my skin color and things like that, and I didn't take it lightly. And so I just always felt like militant and on edge. So when I was little, I used to have insecurities about my lips. Big lip Tamika, I mean, just all kinds of stuff. If there was a hangman and the kids were able to choose what the words were, sometimes they would say things about my lips on the hangman. And we're sitting here guessing A, B, and then it comes out to be something negative about me. So one day I had this epiphany that everybody's not against me. Just because they're white doesn't mean they're against me. And so I kind of had to go into this forgiveness phase. I had to forgive myself for how I treated all of them as if they were the ones that had harmed me. And once I had done that, then it kind of freed me. But also, I learned a lot from that experience. What happens to you as a child just kind of makes you to who you are as an adult. It helped me to be more comfortable around all people.
Before Tamika decided to start her own brand, she worked at a big box makeup store where she witnessed quite a lot of racism. It was that experience that led her to create her own company.
There was a lot of times where I was the only Black woman on the floor. So I'm around all these huge companies, and then there's me. And because I have a passion for people, I didn't like selling, but I like people. The other young ladies were about their sales. They didn't care about the people. So their customer service wasn't very friendly. The people couldn't relax and let their hair down. So I ended up having the most sales. There was some young women on the floor that were making very terrible racial jokes. And then management kept having me follow Black women around the store to see if they were stealing. And so prior to me leaving the store, I said, you better get them because what they're saying is not okay. So then COVID happened, we're furloughed, and then we had the civil unrest. the murder of George Floyd.
Today we learned that Minnesota's first confirmed case of COVID-19 coronavirus is here.
Well, over the past month, we've all been through a lot of changes.
We've adapted to our new normal and found that we really are stronger together.
And so all those things were happening at one time and we're all in the house. For me, I'm a creative person, so I needed to get busy with my hands because my anxiety was so elevated. I knew that I need to do something besides sit on the couch. I figured out how to make lipsticks, but all of them came out wrong. Some had a round curve when they came out the mold. Some were broken. So I was like, I can't. It pushed me to figure out an alternative once my job called me and said, are you ready to come back to work? I said, have you dealt with the racism on the floor? They said, oh yeah, we're working on it. You're trying to pacify me. Don't do that. I understand you're not working on it. So I'm gonna go to a plan B for my own life. Everything just aligned and God opened the doors. And that's where I am now because this is where I'm supposed to be. Some people try to get places too fast and they end up missing steps. When you jump and you're jumping past steps, you can get rocked. Take the steps, don't rush it. Because it's a hard business, right? Business is hard in general, but having a beauty brand in Minnesota where there is no blueprint can be very difficult too. So I'm always trying to figure this whole thing out. And sometimes when I want to give up, I feel a physical push, or that I'm standing taller because I'm standing on my grandma who was 4'9".
Thank you for listening. I'm honored to share Tamika Jones's voice. And in sharing her story, we give language to the most original way older women in our community share with us history. For KFI, this is Sundas Hasanoli.
You've been listening to Miniculture on KFAI. Support for Miniculture on KFAI is provided by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. For more stories like this, check out the Miniculture tab on kfai.org.
KFAI is excited to welcome Melbourne, Australia's progressive extreme metal maestros, Neo Obliviscaris, performing two albums in full, 2023's Exol and 2014's Citadel, Tuesday, November 25th at Fine Line in Minneapolis. With support from Rivers of Nile and Psychroptic, this show is guaranteed to have you exhaling what remains of reason. Tickets for Neo Obliviscaris, Rivers of Nile, and Psychroptic are available now at First Avenue's website. Visit first-avenue.com for more details.
Programming on KFAI is sponsored by Community Action Partnership of Ramsey and Washington County's Energy Assistance Program. The Energy Assistance Program helps low-income households pay a portion of their energy bills. You only need 1 month of income verification and a copy of your energy bill when you submit your application. Please make sure you have this documentation as it will help expedite your application processing. In addition to energy assistance, we also offer referrals to our CAPRW Home Weatherization Program. Ramsey and Washington County residents may call 651-645-6470 or visit the website at caprw.org for more information and to apply online.
Support for KFAI comes from Pillar, presenting Pool Boy in their Pillar Forum, Thursday, December 4th. Indie rockers Pool Boy have been performing since 2015. Their music explores themes of intimacy and personal growth through a measured soundscape. They're touring on their latest release, Persona, opening a show are Full Catholic and Laura Hugo. More information about Pool Boy in the Pillar form is available at pillar.com.
This is Mini Culture Presents here on KFAI. My name is Michael Whetstone, and you are listening to Fresh Air Community Radio, people-powered radio, KFAI 90.3 FM in these Twin Cities. Support for this program comes from KFAI listener members and what was the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. And as you have probably heard, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting is no more. It is now our job to keep places like KFAI on the radio. Please consider making a donation or becoming a sustaining member of this great radio community at our website, kfai.org. Just click the donate button there. It is safe, secure, and greatly appreciated. Thank you.
You're listening to Mini Culture on KFAI. Inspired by his love of punk and garage band music of the 1980s, John Clifford started a hair salon by Loring Park in Minneapolis. It's a funky, one-of-a-kind place, helmed by a funky, one-of-a-kind guy, filled with music and Minnesota music memorabilia. He later added a record store, focusing on local music next to the salon, creating, quote, the best waiting room in the city. A welcoming place for a haircut, Hi-Fi Hair and Records is filled with John's craftsmanship, humor, creativity, and a feel-good sense of community. KFAI's Dixie Trichel has the story.
Thank you for calling Hi-Fi Hair and Records.
I'm Johnny Clifford. I have Hi-Fi Hair and Records. My initial training was at the old Horst Mansion over on LaSalle prior to it becoming the big, huge Aveda Institute that it is today. It was just a really cool, funky little art school. I cut hair and I sell records and tell bad jokes. I came into hair because of music. I just wanted to have a really cool little Greenwich Village kind of rock and roll hair salon where it would be just a good community hang and fill the walls with all the crap that I've collected over the years. I've always kind of looked at it as, do I want to do a haircut or do I want to make a haircut? So throughout my entire career of 40 plus years, it's been an amalgamation of bits and pieces of things that I've seen, whether it's hair, whether it's architecture, whether it's flowers, whether it's whatever, and trying to incorporate that into what I do, how I visualize things. About 1980, 81, my friends and I were all discovering, you know, the local garage and punk music that was going on. We all wanted to have cool hair, but none of us had any money. So I started cutting my own hair, and I started cutting all of their hair. It dawned on me that, damn, I guess this would be a cool job. So to me, music has always been that influence behind how people want to look.
Jim Crego. So this is only my third time. But now that I come here, I can't not come here. And I let it grow out enough that he can work some magic with it. He's amazing. There's none better.
Well, I'm going to bring Jim over to the shampoo bowl, and then we're going to cut some hair. So give me a couple minutes. We'll be back in two and two.
Oh, geez. Oh, sorry. I didn't mean to get you all wet, Jim. Oh, my God. Oh, we're going to need some more towels.
A lot of what I do is by feel. Can you kids at home see this? Yeah? Okay, all right. Kind of having a visual in my head of a shape, right? I'm a little unorthodox in comparison to the way a lot of people cut. And
with the absolute best results.
Yeah.
If you didn't have the technique, you wouldn't be able to realize your vision, John.
I liken it to watching Keith Moon drum. If ever there was an incredible drummer out there who everybody looked at and said, what the heck is he doing?
Exactly.
It would be Keith Moon, right?
Mm-hmm.
Hi-Fi Hair. I've got the entire wall in the back, which is all local Minnesota stuff, completely dedicated to that. And then there's also local Minnesota stuff just scattered randomly throughout. Some of its posters and photos. On the mannequin there is Slim Dunlap's suit that he wore on his last tour with the Replacements. You know, I think that that's pretty huge to me. Got this fantastic photo of Curtis A, along with other stuff from Curtis A throughout the room, but to me, he's the quintessential rock and roll icon of the Twin Cities. What else is around here that is pretty freaking awesome? I don't know. There's so much. This photo back here of the wallets. Nobody talks about the wallets enough. They were fun, and they were funky, and they were all crazy talented. And you never knew what you were going to see when you went to a wallet show. Really kind of hit their heyday in the early 80s. Most famous for their song Totally Nude. I had opened this place, Hi-Fi Hair, and there was this space next door that was vacant, on again, off again. And I had a conversation with John Cass of Go Johnny Go Records, and we were just talking about how cool it would be to have a record store that focused more on local music. And lo and behold, we opened a little record store next door. I lovingly call it the best waiting room in the city. Whatever success this place might have, parlay itself into doing something nice for the community in the process, that's a really cool bonus.
Honestly, though, John, you make people feel better.
I've come to a point in my career in which people just sit down and they trust me and let me just do my thing. It is a rare day when a local musician isn't in here getting their hair cut. That's a very rare day.
You're listening to Mini Culture on KFAI. When Palmer's Bar said farewell to Minneapolis, beloved piano player Cornbread Harris drew a big crowd. But Harris says that's nothing compared to the 50s when he played rock and roll with Augie Garcia. Michelle Brook has the story.
The River Road Club is long gone. The site under the Mendota Bridge is now parkland. But musician Cornbread Harris remembers it well.
A lady would come to the door and say, come in, please.
In the 50s, he played piano at the club with Augie Garcia, known as the godfather of Minnesota rock and roll.
Be so quiet and everybody be so peaceful. And Augie would say, stop, stop, stop. And you never knew what the song was until he started doing whatever the song was. Oh, man. Hang in, baby. We're going for a ride. The audience went wild for that dude. He had the top down on a grand piano. And he would be up on that dancing to his music. Mr. Willie Brown was a saxophone player. I mean, that gentleman could blow that horn. Oh, beautiful, beautiful, beautiful. 6 nights a week, and there's only 7, so.
The Augie Garcia Quintet released a handful of singles in the 50s that became local hits and sold 100,000 copies.
Good, simple stuff, you know. Don't get too complicated. You're taking all my books, helping me to school. You're taking all my books, helping me to school. My Ivy League baby, don't think I am no fool. Oh, yeah, oh, I believe, baby.
The Minnesota Music Hall of Fame says their 1955 song, Hi-Yo Silver, is believed to be the state's first rock and roll recording.
Beautiful recording, I thought. For us uneducated recording people, it wasn't bad.
One of the band's most memorable gigs was opening for Elvis at the St. Paul Auditorium in 1956. Elvis was 21 years old. He'd just released his first album. His manager did not want Elvis sharing the stage with anyone who might be considered a rival rock and roller.
We opened for Elvis, and we opened too. We got kicked off the stage because we opened too good. We upstaged anybody.
After Cornbread left the band, the group continued performing up and down Lake Street in Minneapolis. That's where Augie met his wife, Nancy. She was sitting in the audience at a club called Swedes. I asked Nancy what it was like to date Augie at this time.
You always knew where they were. Because he couldn't get out of that. People always told him that they could travel, you know, but most of the guys didn't want to. Because they were married and had, some of them had families.
The band broke up in the early 60s. Augie told PBS he got tired of working almost every night of the week. It was kind of a lonesome life. A River Road bouncer helped Augie land a new job as an iron worker building skyscrapers in downtown Minneapolis. Augie liked the views and said he had no regrets. The band reunited for a couple of shows in 1996.
That's actually the first time I ever saw him perform.
This is one of Augie's daughters, Angie Garcia.
The way he could control the crowd and get them dancing, because everyone was dancing that night. And just to see him with that big smile on his face, too, was just something else, too. So that was good. It's a good memory.
Augie was born and raised at St. Paul's West Side Flats, a neighborhood that included Jewish, Lebanese, and Mexican immigrants. The river often flooded in the spring, and the city decided to demolish the flats in the early 60s, displacing more than 2,000 people. Augie often talked about his old friends from the neighborhood.
And he used to have a St. Bernard dog, and he would hook him up to a sled and take the kids for a ride.
Augie's uncle taught him guitar, and he started out playing Mexican ballads.
He would play with his uncle and his dad. They liked to sing and carry on.
Augie stayed connected to the West Side. He helped raise money for a neighborhood school and played guitar at Our Lady of Guadalupe. As a Korean War veteran, he also raised money for a veterans memorial installed in 1998 at the state capitol.
And then he really worked hard to get the memorial, because he was already sick by then.
Augie underwent radiation for esophageal cancer in 1987. The treatment worked, and for years he continued performing solo around town. But after the band reunion, the cancer came back.
Even towards the end, when he couldn't talk, because the second time he got through cancer, they had to take out his voice box and that, and he had a trach tube and couldn't talk very well, let alone sing. He would still sit in our sunroom and play the guitar, and you could close his eyes and he'd rock back and forth and just play the guitar, and you could just see that just helped calm him and make him feel better.
Augie died in 1999 at the age of 67. Reflecting on his career in a tape recording, he said if he had to do it over again, he wouldn't change a thing. He'd have the same musicians, and it would be an honor to play with them again. He said, "If you run into me in one of those little nightclubs, please bring up the 50s. If you want to get an earful, you'd be talking to the right guy."
That was, again, some wonderful days.
Cornbread Harris is 98 years old now.
You want to play a piano a little bit?
And he's still performing every Sunday night at Schooner Tavern in Minneapolis.
That is the boogie boogie all at home.
This is Michelle Brook for KFAI.
Special thanks to Andrea Swenson and Rick Aguilar. You've been listening to Miniculture on KFAI. In the 90s, a radio station, 93.7 The Edge, popped up and imprinted itself onto the minds and hearts of many young Minnesotans who were aching for new music. The Cranberries, Nirvana, Pearl Jam, No Doubt. Radio back then wasn't just a way to listen to music, but a way to discover music. The station also hosted Edge Fest, which forged even stronger connections and memories. Every generation has a nostalgic love for the music of their youth, and Edge fans are no different. KFAI's Matthew Schneeman talked to these fans, now all grown up, about their love for the Edge and 90s alt rock.
In 1994, the station known as 93X changed its format and became
93.7 The Edge, KEGE, Minneapolis, St. Paul.
And they promised to be Minnesota's new rock alternative. What does that mean? Some teenagers, millennials and Gen Xers now, defined it for me.
Anything by Blind Melon, Stone Temple Pilots,
Jane's Addiction, Beastie Boys, like all that stuff.
Some Smashing Pumpkins.
Nirvana,
Pearl Jam,
Tori Amos, Fiona Apple,
Alice in Chains.
The music was defiant and often anti-corporate, but there was an irony at the heart of The Edge. It was owned by Disney. It was corporate. It was a giant station and often bragged about the strength of its signal.
You've got an incredible, huge 100,000-watt transmitter. 1 billion milliwatts.
Minnesota's new. Niche music for everyone. It was a contradiction for sure. But to the teens coming of age during the station's brief four-year run, it was a musical lifeline.
I was in high school, and that was the first station that played music that I really liked.
And the station came out of the gate swinging. Here's John Lastman, program director for The Edge.
We had to cleanse the palate, and we knew if we just started playing our format, a lot of people might not even notice the difference. So we thought we'd do something to really call attention to it.
And so, to cleanse the palate, so to speak, they kicked off the station with a pretty weird stunt. Here's an Edge fan named Joe.
Distinctly remember when they switched over and they played REM for like 2 or 3 days straight.
Joe was a teenager working at the Ground Round out in Roseville. And that weekend, The Edge played REM's song, It's the End of the World as We Know It, on loop all weekend straight.
The cooks on purpose put it on there and loud just to drive people crazy.
Here's another fan, Brandon, who was on the bus with his hockey team waiting to leave.
People were filtering, slowly getting on the bus. This song came on and just kept playing and playing. Everybody kind of had the same suspicion that something isn't right here. Is this song really supposed to be this long? Does it really keep going like that? And finally, one big guy, is a defenseman, just a huge guy, pipes up and says, long song, eh? And we all just died. It just cracked us up because we're all thinking the same thing, but nobody wanted to say it.
John Lastman, program director again.
The cops were showing up because people were calling the police. They thought somebody had died. It was insane.
Yeah, I remember like telling my mom.
Jason, another fan.
I don't know what's going on the radio station, but they keep playing the same song over and over. And she's like, well, maybe you should call the station and see if they're okay. And I remember trying to call them, but I was like, wait a minute. There's something going on here. There's something going on here.
The funny thing is, now if you were to do that stunt, you could just hit replay and it would play all weekend. Well, we actually had to have some poor kid in the studio with three copies of the REM CD playing it over and over.
And thus began 93.7 The Edge. At first, I thought what made The Edge so cool and specific was the music. But what a lot of people remember isn't specific songs, but what they were doing as they listened. Playing the board game Risk with friends, the computer game Civilization, or driving to school.
I mean, I remember I had like a actual like dial-in radio Walkman. If I was riding my bike and I went off a jump or a bump or something, I would lose, you know, half the signal, and I'd have to like readjust to, you know, hear The Offspring.
Or lack of technology.
One time I went to Uptown with somebody I just met, and then like school ended. So then the summers I would drive around trying to figure out where Uptown was. There was no Google Maps back then.
You lost Uptown. The biggest memories were of mixtapes and recording music right off the air.
Yeah, in 93.7 The Edge, like I just remember like just hovering over the radio and just waiting until I heard like Nine Inch Nails, The Perfect Drug.
And then you had to wait. I made one tape. I think the first song I recorded was Shine.
This is my older brother, Dan.
What band that was?
Yeah, well, I don't know.
Keep me on the do-do-do-do.
Oh, Collective Soul.
Collective Soul. Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And then I discovered The Edge, and there was no cassette tape in the house that was safe for me recording over it.
I might have had a like Fiona Apple / Tori Amos cassette.
I do remember trying to record Downward Spiral for a girl I liked, and I tried like muting every swear word into it because I didn't think she would like it. I'm sure it's something terrible, but
along with recording music off the air and trading cassette tapes, the other thing people remember about The Edge was Edgefest, the annual festival held out in Somerset, Wisconsin.
I remember like crazy traffic going through Stillwater. There were cops
A buddy of mine was a state trooper.
On both sides of the highways.
In Stillwater, arresting everybody drunk coming back from Edgefest, but I don't know.
Waiting to pull people over.
I remember going to the campsite at Float Right campsite.
We didn't get a hotel or a campsite because we didn't know better. And
that was crazy. That was a lot of fun.
We slept on an air mattress in the back of my parents' minivan in the Anderson Window parking lot.
I even remember one Edgefest, my best friend and I, we ended up in a fist fight together.
This is Alexa, an Edge fan who loved Edgefest, but was also a bit self-destructive before she was able to come out as a trans woman.
Hitting each other in the face as hard as we could, and there was a crowd all around us like, fight, fight, fight. And we both looked at each other and said, what the f*** are we doing? Like, this is my homie, man.
But I remember Cake had played, and there was like a, I don't know if it was Pizza Hut or Domino's or something.
One of the vendors was Domino's Pizza, and the sun is starting to set.
And during Cake's performance, everybody started throwing all their pizza boxes up in the air.
And it looks like graduation with everybody throwing their caps up in the air.
Thousands of them flying all over from, you know, day two.
I had another person, he said it looked like graduation caps.
Yes, that's the exact vibe.
And my mom was like, what is this? I was like, it's pizza boxes. She's like, well, why would you take pictures of that? That seems stupid. And I was like, because it was cool and it looked like graduation and everybody was just having fun. And
it was just fun, you know, and I was young enough where, you know, it was all kind of innocent and we just enjoyed it so much.
The festival was a success, and it didn't cost too much, too. My brother's ticket stub from back in the day shows that for one day it was just $25. Another person said it was just $40 for the whole weekend. Here's John again.
And it was really great. We could keep the prices low because we were playing all of the current music from these bands. Yes, they would do the show for either free or if you were really established, a lot less than it would, you know, usually cost you. So I know we had no doubt when their album was five times platinum for like $5,000. Same with Bush. We had Green Day when they were just starting out.
The festival wasn't the only success the Edge had.
Well, I'm proud to say that 93.7 The Edge was the highest rated major market alternative station in the country.
So they had great ratings too. So if they were so successful, why did they only last from 94 to 97? Short answer, media consolidation. The Edge already was part of Disney, ABC, and in 1996, the Telecommunications Act relaxed ownership rules, and the Edge's parent company was allowed to buy out their rival station, Rev 105. And they consolidated the alt-rock programming into that frequency. On the last day that The Edge broadcasted under that name, they repeated their opening stunt and played REM's It's the End of the World as We Know It, this time with an added irony, on loop for 24 hours straight.
I'm sure everyone puts the story of what was it, they went off air, they were playing the REM until it's the end of the world.
I thought it was cool. I think it reminded me, I mean, a couple things, like video killed the radio star.
Yeah, it's like they're trying to be like a copy of the Russian, the Soviet Union film. They just put the ballet on. I forget which one it was, the ones, the swans.
Oh, you're right. Yeah.
I was 13 and a half when it went off the air, and I had no idea it was happening, and I turned on the radio, and it was my very first preset.
For this fan, Adam, the loss of the Edge hurt. It was changing from alternative rock to heavy metal, 93.7 The Edge to 93X.
And they started playing heavy metal music, rock music, 93X, and I was like, what the hell's going on? And I tried like doing, you know, adjust the dial a little bit, and no, like it wasn't there. And I remember asking somebody up at school about it the next day, and they're like, oh yeah, it's the X now. And I was heartbroken, absolutely heartbroken. It was like losing a pet or something.
To me, The Edge represents the 90s in all its contradictions. Big business playing anti-consumerism music. Not caring, but doing it in a very mainstream way. fan of the Edge, Elizabeth put it wonderfully.
You know, I think when I think of other things from that era that really like was like a cultural alternative like thing, like do you remember Surge soda?
Yeah.
Like I feel like it's kind of interchangeable, you know, like that kind of like you think you've discovered something new and like quirky and offbeat, but it's really still made by like a major corporation. You know, maybe there's some analogies to the Edge there.
The Edge was as 90s radio station could be. Grungy, snarky, and corporate. And was beautiful, in my opinion, because of, and not in spite of, its conflicting ethos.